show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Prospectus affiliate. Folks, we have a very special show in store for you today. This show today marks the 100th recording that we've had since we've been with BP Kansas City, with Baseball Prospectus. So, you know, of course, we've definitely had well over 100 in our history. You know, we've had a few hundred, but this kind of commemorates the 100th show since we've been a part of the Baseball Prospectus team and have had the BP Kansas City tag under it. So pretty cool. And we've got a kind of a special segment here that we'll get to after we cover some things. Before we get into all that, I, of course, am for the 100th time with BP Kansas City. I am Jeff Herr, and with me, as always, is the man who's always bringing it at 100, Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this joyous occasion for us?
Yeah. A couple things that I'll also point out. I mean, I'm doing great, just to answer your question. But you're also omitting the fact that today is your birthday. So happy birthday.
It is, in fact, my birthday. Thank you.
It's also an anniversary of the Lorenzo Cain 3 home run loss. Which,
of course, yes.
Sorry.
It happens.
To bring that back up.
That was kind of a bittersweet thing.
Yeah. And it's also like 6 years ago, we were reminded by Troy Olson on Facebook today that we kind of announced that we were going to be doing a show from the studios at Union Broadcasting, which... you know, basically that point gave birth to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, which was done in conjunction with the Kansas City Baseball Historical Society, thanks to Jeff Logan. So at that point, we were doing the Royal Man Report and Baseball Vault, and then morphed into just doing the Vault and
kind of rebranded after that.
Yeah, and here we are. So it's appropriate that we get to have a milestone on a day like this. There's a lot of stuff going on. So yeah, really kind of excited to give you guys a little special segment, in the second part of this show that, we spent a decent amount of time this week. I mean, we didn't work for like all year towards this.
Oh no.
We spent about 5 days, which is about 4 days and 22 hours more than we spent normally, to give you this. But you know, we'll get to that in a minute. You know, but yeah, otherwise, yeah, doing well. It's warm out. We missed spring. We jumped right into summer.
Straight in there, just 90 degrees.
Just boom. So, you know, that's the Midwest for you.
Yep. My, you know, a couple of years ago, we were looking to, because when we first moved in, we, to the house we're at now, my wife and I, we kind of got all the landscape, took us a couple of years to get all the landscaping to the point where we could kind of do our own thing. So we went and tried to get some plants. So we were talking to people, you know, when can we start planting, et cetera. And the rule of thumb is always after Mother's Day, because the guy was like, we've had freezes in May, you know, and those will kill your plants. But yeah, this year, none of that so far. It's like, it just kind of hit May. We had those days where it was like 20 degrees a couple times, like a month ago, and then all of a sudden it was just boom, here we are at 90 degrees. So fun times,
yeah,
in the Midwest. but I much prefer the heat to the cold. Very, very excited that it's starting to get nice weather. Taking some walks, don't have to wear a coat every morning, et cetera, et cetera. Those are nice. So I suppose we should start talking about some Royals here.
Yep.
The Kansas City Royals, folks, have solidified themselves as not the worst team in baseball. So that's nice. There's at least three teams that are behind them now. Well, not at least. There is three teams behind them now. And who knows, you know, by the end of the season, six, seven teams, maybe worse than the Royals. I mean, fingers crossed here.
You're going crazy there.
I know. But that is to say that, you know, the Royals are starting to play better. So a team that was 5-20 at one point is now 12-24. So if you can do the math there, that means the Royals have been 7-4 in their last 11 games. So pretty solid. You know, you'll take that. Absolutely. If they won 7 out of every 11 games, they'd be in the playoffs, 100%.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't expect that type of a clip to continue. They've kind of lucked out playing some they played better than I think many expected against the Red Sox, but they're playing the Orioles right now, and the Orioles just may be, I mean, record-wise, they already are worse than the Royals, but, I mean, they may just be actually plain old just worse than the Royals. They are just not good. And the you know, I think the expectations for the Orioles were that, I don't know that they were super high, but they were much better than the expectation-wise. They were thinking they were going to be much better than they are. To the point where they could at least maybe compete for a wild card, I think, is what the feeling in Baltimore was, and they're just not having it at all. So they're going to squander the last year of Manny Machado, most likely trade him at some point. I don't really feel too bad, to be honest with you.
No, I don't either.
I don't really have too many warm thoughts about the Orioles. That sucks, but hey, it is what it is. We put in our time,
yep,
as Royals fans. Back to the point, you know, Royals have started to play a little bit better, and we hit on it last week a little bit, seeing, you know, both Alex Gordon and Jorge Soler, and seeing them, you know, hit better and perform better at the plate, and what that means for the team moving forward. And it's continued. You know, now we're looking at, on the season, Jorge Soler is hitting .321, .431, .545. It's a .975 OPS. Alex Gordon is hitting .313 with a .368 on base, .463 slug. I mean, that's like 2011 Alex Gordon numbers here. So, and then you've got Mike Moustakas, who is hitting just below .300, but he's got 10 home runs already. So, he hasn't been back for super long, but Salvador Perez is back, and he's already got 4 home runs now, because he just hit another one tonight because it's his birthday as well. Salvador Perez and I share a birthday, which is fun. But he hit a grand slam tonight already against the Orioles. So the offense is starting to pick up. Now, part of it is that they're going up against some lesser teams, but, you know, they were still able to score some runs against the Red Sox, who, are better, one of the best teams in baseball. So, you know, things are starting to look up a little bit. You know, it could be, I remember the 2012, the great our time season. They started off 3-2, and then it was Jonathan Broxton beamed. I can't remember who it was, but somebody on the A's.
It was Cespedes. Loaded.
Oh, that's right. That is right.
It's easy Cespedes to forget he was an A, but yeah.
It was, yeah. But he beans him. The bases were loaded. In comes the winning walk-off run, the walk-off beaning, and then they lose. They go on to lose 11 more after that, so they start off 3-14, similar to, you know, starting off 5-20 this year. But then they don't play that bad the rest of the way, you know, the rest of the season. So this year could be similar, you know, not to say that, oh, if they wouldn't have started off bad, they might have made the playoffs. I still don't think they'll be at that point, but, you know, it could be a thing where, hey, you know, if they didn't start off as bad, maybe the season looks just a little bit better. You know, if they end up 72-90, then, you know, maybe they could have been 78-84, and that looks a little bit better on paper. Makes you feel a little bit better about where the organization is. but regardless, you know, it's still nice to see some of the developments that we've seen. And, you know, there's still a lot of questions, a lot of holes on this team, but seeing Alex Gordon come back, and seeing Mike Moustakas continue the success he's had for the last couple of years, and seeing Jorge Soler start to emerge, you know, and even Lucas Duda, you know, he has he's putting up very Duda-like numbers, and starting to, you know, he said he hit a home run again tonight, so he's hitting home runs kind of like we thought he would, which is at a decent pace. So, you know, there is at least, despite the record, you know, 12-24 is not good, but there's at least some excitement. You know, it feels a little bit more fun to watch. You know, and that was what we were talking about in the offseason too. You know, we're like, if it does go south for the team, which it did very early, at least give us something fun to watch. You know, and the first couple weeks of the season, first month of the season, there wasn't anything fun. It was just bad. But now there's at least a little bit fun. You know, they're doing more. More royal things that are fun. And when you get, you know, people, even on the pitching side, you know, it's fun to watch Kelvin Herrera this year, who's been doing a lot better, et cetera. So that's a little bit nice. You know, it's as the weather is getting better, it's starting to get a little bit, you know, I don't necessarily say I'd feel positive about the Royals right now in terms of where they are, but it's starting to feel more positive and like I said, more fun to watch the team, which, in a season that most likely will end without any playoffs, that's kind of the best you can hope for.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're a fan of the Royals, you're going to be a baseball fan, and you want to watch your team. And most of the time, you know, you just turn on the game, you have it on, whatever. And for me, I want to be entertained by it. I want to have, you know, something enjoyable to watch. And maybe that's, you know, certain players playing well. Maybe that's just the team coming through in situations more frequently. And the last couple of weeks, they've been a lot easier to watch. The bullpen has settled down significantly from where they were before. I mean, it helps to send Brandon Maurer down, and it helps that, you know, Justin Grimm hasn't been pitching, and they were two of the worst pitchers. But you know, you get to see Brad Keller start to kind of figure some things out at this level. You see Kevin McCarthy come up, and despite giving up the hit last night that ended up beating the Royals, he's pitched pretty well. Tim Hill's interesting to watch. Even like Brian Flynn, when he's gotten in there, that he's pretty entertaining. But then you get into like Danny Duffy won his first game the other night. You know, he got 10 runs in the first inning to help him along that way, but, you know, he's still got the win. Jake Junis has pitched great with the exception of basically like one start. Ian Kennedy, until the night, has pitched pretty well. Eric Skoglund's even shown some flashes. So you start to see where, you know, maybe not everybody's very good, but at least they're kind of fun to watch. And, you know, then when you look on the offensive side, Soler, he entered the game today second in the American League in on-base percentage. I mean, that's ridiculous. You look at Alex Gordon and what he's doing so far, really seems like it's for real. There's a piece on Royals.com by Jeffrey Flanagan talking about some of those adjustments. Dave Lesky talked about his plate discipline today or yesterday and kind of how that's helped fuel this resurgence. And, you know, just seeing those two who were so disappointing last year come through now is really nice to see. Plus, Moustakas is on pace for like 45 home runs. He looks just as good as he did last year from a power standpoint. So there's a lot of things that, you know, you can kind of point to and kind of enjoy. Whit Merrifield has 8 stolen bases, 4 in the last week, including like 3 on the Dress of the Nines Day where they saluted the Negro Leagues. So he's in this Monarchs gear and steals 3 bases. Perfect.
Nice.
Absolutely yes. Perfect. So including just like they weren't covering third, so he just took it. It's fantastic.
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
I mean, that's great.
They had a huge shift on, so there was no mistake. He was just like, well, and they were – I was asking my dad, maybe you know the answer to this question. Does that go down as a steal, or is that defensive indifference on that? Because the catcher came up to throw, but there was nobody there because of the shift. So do you know how that's scored?
Yeah, it's still a steal.
It's still a steal. Okay.
I think defensive indifference really only comes into play when it's very clear that they're not holding a guy on late. They're not trying to defend the stolen base because of the game situation and not necessarily just because they're in a shift. But I mean, he took advantage of where they were, and Jorge Soler was right behind him on the next moment. So yeah, it was really fun. So those are the kind of things that you're watching. And then another thing that happened in the last week, we talked about his call up, but Jason Adam made his major league debut. which, you know, if you've listened to this show for any length of time, you know that Jason Adams probably been the one guest we've had on most frequently up until the point when he was traded in 2014. You know, just a great guy, and you watch how the other players reacted when he made it into the clubhouse and into the dugout and on the day of his debut, and you can kind of tell what impact he has on his teammates. So to see him come out in Kansas City, make his debut in front of his family, in front of friends, in his hometown team, really cool. He got a strikeout. He gave up a hit. You know, it was pretty nondescript kind of inning, but it was really cool to just see him there after all those years of coming back. There's a really good piece at The Athletic by Rustin Dodd, kind of talking about a lot of the steps that Jason Adam took to get back here. And so, like, that combined with playing better makes it for an interesting past couple of weeks. So it's really nice to kind of see how those guys are playing, you know, now, compared especially to where they were, you know, a month ago, where they were just miserable. So, you know, I don't think they're going to end up making a put. You know, some guys were talking, oh, they're only five back of Cleveland. It's like, okay, hold on. Settle down.
Yes.
Yeah, you're not wrong. It's just, you know, context. It definitely matters.
Yes.
You know, I don't think if you're 12-23 at the time when that was said, which was before yesterday's game, I don't think it really matters how far back you are. You've shown that you're only winning a third of your games. But,
yeah,
you know, I don't think they're going to get there. But, you know, if they can give us some entertainment along the way and you see some development from guys who will be here next year and beyond, that's what you're looking for. And right now they're kind of starting to show some signs of really coming along in that field.
Yeah, it's super exciting. And, you know, I feel like that kind of stuff catches on with the team, you know, because when you're losing, it sucks. But when you're losing and everyone's playing bad and you're losing, you know, sometimes some people can play well and you're still losing. But when you're losing and everyone's playing bad, it's like, this just sucks, you know, and nobody's happy. Everyone. So, of course, it just kind of builds on itself and the motivation starts to decrease. You know, it's just human nature. But when you've got people we've talked about, you know, Jorge Soler and Alex Gordon and Mike Moustakas and Lucas Duda, people, you know, start to play better. And then younger guys like Jason Adam come up and have some success. You know, that kind of stuff gets people excited, even in the clubhouse, I think, and becomes kind of infectious. And so, you know, happier people play better baseball. And, you know, I think that's when there's a little bit more reason to have a little bit more bounce in your step, I think it does carry on to the field. You know, obviously only so much. But I think it's certainly something that has some relevance. So that's definitely cool. But, and, you know, of course, as we say that, the Royals just squander the lead.
Well, you know.
You know, it happens.
It was entertaining to start with, so.
Yeah. There's lots of runs, at least. So there's that. But so I think we'll kind of not end the show, but end the kind of the current segment there, and we'll move on to our special segment that we've planned, and something that Mike put together, and dealing with thought it would be appropriate that on our 100th show that we go back and take a nostalgic look at the 2002 season, which is notable for the only reason that it was the Royals' first 100 loss season. And it's nostalgia now because we came out on the other side, right? If the Royals hadn't won in 2015, it might feel a little bit different. But right now you can look back and say, you know what? I don't know if you'd say it was worth it to go through that, but at least we came out on the other side. So, you put it together a ton of good stuff here, so why don't you kind of detail some of the stuff you found when you were looking up all this stuff, because it's quite fascinating when you really take a look back and look at everything.
Yeah, we're kind of Andy Dufresne in that sense. That yeah, I'm sure he's really nostalgic for Shawshank, but you know,
yeah,
only because he got out.
Exactly.
Yeah, let's take a trip back in time. Let's go to 2002. Nickelback is at the top of the charts. Ross and Rachel are pregnant. We're two Spider-Mans ago, and Tobey Maguire is slinging webs all over the place. It's a great time to be alive. You know, just for some background before we get into the actual team, we kind of took a look at 100 lost seasons historically. And, you know, I wasn't sure if it was kind of a more regular thing or if it's regular now in the expansion era or whatnot. Generally, you know, you look in the expansion era, there's about 1.28 100 lost seasons per year. There's a bunch of years where there's nobody who lost 100 games, and there's somewhere two or three teams lost 100 games. In 2002, it happened that four teams lost 100 games.
Wow.
Which is pretty amazing. I mean, how rough would that be to lose 100 games and you don't even get the second pick or the third pick in the draft the next year? So I really focused a little bit more on the expansion era for a couple of reasons. One, more teams, since the Royals are an expansion team starting in 1969, I wanted to kind of compare them to other expansion teams to see how they rate as a franchise in this kind of category. Another reason is because once the league started to expand in 1961, they changed the number of games per season from 154 to 162, which you might remember the movie 61, where that was a big point of contention because Babe Ruth had hit 60 home runs in a 154 game season and Roger Maris hit 61 home runs in 162 games. Now, you know, been obliterated a couple times, but you know, I figure if you were looking at it where all these teams have 162 games in which to lose 100, I think that's a good kind of vantage point to get an idea of where the Royals stand. Some interesting things that I want to drop in just before we get to the Royals. It doesn't necessarily have to be that there's 162 games or even 154 for a team to lose, because in 1890, the Pittsburgh Alleghenies, in a 136-game season, only won 23 games. They were 23-113, a 169 winning percentage. The different times, for sure. But then you look at other teams like the Giants, the Reds. They've lost 100 games one time, and in both cases, it was 100 years after they had entered the league. Pretty remarkable. I thought that was pretty cool. But just as a kind of a big picture on the expansion teams, five of the 14 expansion teams added since 1961 lost 100 games their first season. We're talking about the Blue Jays, the Montreal Expos, the San Diego Padres, the New York Mets, and the then Washington Senators, who later became the Texas Rangers. All of them, first season, they lost 100 games, including the Mets, who lost 120, infamously. The Mariners entered the league in 1977. They lost 100 games in 1978. A handful of recent teams, the Rays, Diamondbacks, and Marlins, lost 100 games within their first seven seasons. The Marlins doing so after winning the World Series, strangely enough. Two teams have never lost 100 games, that one of those being the Colorado Rockies. But more impressively, the Angels, who began play in 1961, have never lost 100 games.
Wow.
So, I mean, they've been in the 90s, but they haven't lost 100.
Right.
So, pretty interesting to kind of see how that rates. And then there's this other group of longtime holdouts. Houston, they entered the league in 1962. They lost 100 games for the first time in 2011, 50 years.
Wow.
And then in 2002, the same year, two teams lost 100 games for the first time ever, the Milwaukee Brewers and the Kansas City Royals. So I think overall, that puts the Royals in a pretty decent little company that it took them 34 years. Now, granted, they still lost, you know, 100 games 3 years after 2002. So 2004, 2005, 2006, they lost 100 games.
Like a two carried away.
But... yeah. But, you know, they held out as long as they could. So I think that puts them in a pretty good group, and to kind of come out on the other side with the world championship. You know, I think that puts the franchise in an okay spot. You know, and those four times with 100 losses is really kind of in the same ballpark as a lot of expansion teams. If you wanted to go really, really deep, the Oakland A's / Kansas City A's / Philadelphia A's have lost 100 games 16 times since 1901.
Okay.
There's a chunk of time, and a couple of those were in Kansas City, so good for them. But that brings us to that 2002 Kansas City Royals team. And, you know, to really just set them up, it was kind of a rough time. You know, 2001 was difficult because January of that year, they traded Johnny Damon away after they were unable to sign him to an extension. They got Angel Baroa and Roberto Hernandez in return, which, fine. Baroa won Rookie of the Year in 2003. Hernandez was their closer. In July of 2001, they traded Jermaine Dye for Nephi Perez, which is one of the more catastrophic trades that the Royals have ever made. I would say either that one or David Cohn for Ed Hearn. I'm not sure which one's more
painful.
You
had to bring it up.
But they're both pretty bad. And in 2001, they ended up finishing 65-97. So, you know, not like they were trending and things went badly. They just weren't very good. So when they entered 2002, they were looking for a number of things. They lost, you know, some significant defensive ability in losing Damon and Dye the year before. Ray Sanchez also left. They didn't really have a leadoff guy. So they went and they courted Chuck Knobloch, who, you know, wasn't very good anymore. And that's a big reason why they were able to get him. But in
that was when he had like the yips.
Yeah,
couldn't even throw to first base anymore.
He got moved to the outfield, and they signed him as an outfielder in December of 2001. And, you know, in 2001, he had a 250 batting average, but he got on base 339, which isn't bad, you know. But when you compare it to what they got out of Johnny Damon, you know, it fails to really reach up to that. Damon in 2000 had an on-base percentage of 382. You know, Mike Sweeney really stressed that, you know, Damon was a big part of their good offense in 2000. But there was optimism. There was optimism Chuck Knobloch was going to be an answer. The next day after they signed Knobloch, they traded for Michael Tucker, who had been a first-round draft pick of the Royals. He was also going to play in the outfield. They brought back Paul Byrd, who's very important to this season, as we'll get into a little bit later. They brought Daryl May over from Japan. And Aaron Giles signed right after the start of the season, and, you know, contributed. His better years were a couple years later.
Aaron Giles, yeah.
So, you know, with all of that, they added about $4 to $5 million in payroll. There were some questions that the Royals, surprise surprise, would really be leaning on the payroll number. David Glass came out, said that no, he's going to ease up on that. He thought that they could contend. But still, throughout the season, you heard Nephi Perez and Jeff Chupan on the trade block basically all year. You know, and right from the start, Tony Muser, who is pretty notorious as a manager, he started out on the hot seat. So, you know, he really had to come out and produce. Another kind of impact of those moves, Mark Quinn, who was pretty highly touted when he came up, basically got benched or at best set up on a platoon. He also, a week before spring training, broke a rib in one of those fun freak accidents. He was fighting and pretending to be a kung fu master with his brother and hit a chair and broke a rib. So,
as you do.
It's a great way to start your season when your job is on the line. Dee Brown, who was a big-time prospect, never panned out. He was more or less relegated to being, you know, a minor league guy who they would call up to fill in. So, you know, not the best way to kind of start things. But they did start out with a good note. Mike Sweeney, who, you know, after trading Damon, after trading Dye, they signed Mike Sweeney to his extension, 5 years, $55 million. That was right before the season started. So, you know, everybody kind of felt like this is something that we can build on. We've got Mike Sweeney, one of the best right-handed hitters in the game. He's the guy, number three hitter, number four hitter. Anchor him, build around him. You know, now let's get Carlos Beltran. So there was some optimism. You know, they felt like they could maybe do something. Jeff Chupan was the opening day starter. And the Royals, they lost. So They never did very well during this time in April or on opening day, so they lost. End up, by the end of the month, Tony Muser was gone. April 29th, after an 8-15 start, he's fired. John Mizorak moves out of the bullpen. He becomes interim manager for a couple of weeks. And the Royals really took some time to check on, you know, who would be the next manager. You know, they talked to Bucky Dent, who had been brought into the organization in the offseason, kind of in the same type of role that Ned Yost had been brought in 2010. So almost like an understudy. They talked to Buck Showalter, which that would have been interesting to see how things would have developed from there.
Yeah.
Larry Jerker was mentioned, but he was mentioned for every managerial job at that point. Willie Randolph was kind of brought up, but he was always seen as you know, the next manager of the Yankees. The Royals ended up going with Tony Peña, who is
they certainly did.
They felt good about that. So in the middle of May, they brought in Tony Peña. He said all the right things. He was going to bring a lot of energy. But, you know, by June, nothing was really working out. Chuck Knobloch had a .252 on base percentage. Carlos Fabless, who was, you know, notable a couple of years before, was really struggling. Nefi Perez was a disaster, as we kind of would have figured. You know, Mike Sweeney was the only guy worthy of an all-star nod. They had some pitching issues just right at the start of the year. Roberto Hernandez was hurt, so they didn't have a closer for the first month of the season. He came back in May, finally. But, you know, the Royals were basically going by, off Paul Byrd, Jeff Suppan, and a lot of rookies. You know, Miguel Asensio was a Rule 5 pick, and he was making starts. Daryl May, who was so highly touted when they brought him over, was injured, didn't make the opening day roster. He came back shortly after he was injured again. He missed, you know, about 50 days and 38 games with a groin strain. Later on in the year, in July, Mike Sweeney had a hip issue. He missed a month. You know, Jeremy Offelt, that blister. If you Google Jeremy Offelt, I'm pretty sure blister pops up automatically because this was a recurring problem with him. He ended up missing 53 days. They wanted him to be, you know, they thought he might be a closer of the future, and they tried him that in that role later. But, you know, they really also wanted to use him as a starter. You know, Knobloch later injured his forearm, and he missed a number of games. He also, there's one anecdote of one game where he was starting to come back, or had just come back, and, you know, someone wasn't paying attention. I don't know if it was him or Raul Ibanez, but he got nicked by a bat during warm-up swings on the same arm. So, you know, just nothing was working, a lot of injuries. Mark Quinn came back from that injured rib, messed up his hamstring. He really only played for a few weeks. So when you're looking at, you know, a number of those guys and you don't have a lot of talent to begin with, and then a lot of it misses time because of injury, you know, you're in a rough spot. So, you know, overall, you know, the Royals on July 21st, we're not doing too badly. They're 43-55, which is nothing, you know, great, but, you know, it's something where you can finish that out. Maybe you finish around 76, 78 wins. You know, maybe you get hot and you can approach 500. After that, they didn't do too well. they won 19 games the rest of that year. The worst part of all of that is that it wasn't really like one stretch. It's not like a few years later where they lost, 19 games in a row.
Mm-hmm.
They really only had the longest losing streak they had was an 8-game losing streak. Problem is they had two of those. They also had five streaks where they lost six or more games. From July 23rd to August 4th, they lost six games. They won a game. Then they lost another six. So
that's rough.
Pretty rough. But, you know, the one of the bright spots, especially on the pitching side, because the Royals finished, you know, allowing the seventh most runs in team history, the third most in the league in all of baseball that season. They didn't pitch very well. You know, Paul Byrd was basically it. Ronelvis Hernandez, just as an illustration, he made 12 starts that year, had an ERA over 4, and on Baseball Reference, he was their fourth most valuable player by WAR. So, you know, that's the kind of season this was. And the Royals, when Paul Byrd started, they were 17-16. He was really good. He was on a 20-win pace for a lot of that time.
They had that with a group of fans that called themselves the Bird Nest or whatever,
yeah,
didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and like he had that old school wind up and everything, really cool. He pitched well. There was a chance that they would have possibly traded him at the trading deadline. There was talk of a deal that would send him, I think, to the Mets perhaps, or the Angels. I don't recall. They didn't trade him. You know, they wrote it out with him. They finished 17-16 in his starts, but he missed a start. So I wonder. If that one start, that one start would have been a win,
would that have been
maybe
the deal?
That changes things? I don't know. They scored okay. They had the 11th. Let me say this correctly. They finished 11th in the AL in runs scored. However, their 737 runs are still 13th most in Royals history. So they were more or less average. They were really close to average in all of baseball, but the American League was so amped up that the scoring was just crazy, which also explains why they gave up so many runs. You know, the kind of the real final stretch really kind of sunk them quite a lot. You know, when you look at it, they started September at 55-81, not a good record, but you know, it's not quite on pace. Immediately they lose the first 8 games. Just right away in September, they go 0-8 their first 8 games. That included the famous Moneyball game, where they were down 11 to Oakland while Oakland was trying to win their 20th game in a row to set a new record. I don't remember how it goes in the movie, but the Royals tied the score probably about when Brad Pitt returned to the stadium.
Yep, that's what happened.
In fact, with Kit Pelo on the screen. And then, of course, the Royals, after all that effort, they lost on a walk-off, a home run by Scott Hatterberg, Star-Lord himself.
Star-Lord himself.
So that really set them up into a real bad position. Another thing that happened in September of 2002 was that moment in Chicago where Royals first base coach Tom Gamboa was coaching, and two guys just randomly came out to the stands and tried to attack him. The completely random thing that I think a lot of people remember nowadays. So September was not a good month, but they were still going into the last series. They were 62-97. They only had to win one of those three games against Cleveland. You know, the second to last game, they lost it in extras on a walk-off by the Indians. Just, you know, okay, fine. You know, the bullpen blew a lead. They gave up the last run. Not great. Final game of the year, Carlos Beltran hits a home run in the first inning. Darryl May gives him 5 innings, gives up only 2 earned runs. But, you know, it was a pretty crazy lineup, you know, where this is from the Kansas City Star on that particular day. This is written by Bob Dutton. Who got to cover this mess. I'll read this little passage here. Manager Tony Pena offered a lineup Sunday that started Kit Pelo at third in place of Joe Randa. Catcher Dusty Wathan made his first major league start. Carlos Beltran was a designated hitter instead of playing center. Luis Ordaz and Aaron Gile also started. No, it's not the best lineup, Pena acknowledged before the game. But sometimes you're better off playing young players. It's not like I'm trying to throw the game away. We want to win. Perhaps Pena sensed his older players were more interested in getting home for the offseason than in avoiding 100 losses. Or maybe it was another step in an ongoing rebuilding effort that produced a 7-19 mark in September. So they lost that game 7-3. And that was loss 100. 62-100 is the final record for the Royals. They held it off as long as they could, but it really just didn't come to be. They did actually that season. They were 7-2 against the Rangers, which ha ha to them. they also were 10-9 against Cleveland and 10-9 against Detroit. So they at least kind of did something there. But their best month was July, where they went 13-16. They had, you know, only 2 months where they won more than 40% of their games. So pretty miserable. They got 15 wins between April and September combined. Just really bad. Just real bad. You know, the a couple of bright spots in that season, though. You know, Paul Byrd was chasing 20 wins, finished with 17. In June, the Royals selected this guy named Zach Greinke, who I hear later went on to do some good things.
I think he's still around, isn't he?
I think so. I think he's doing okay for himself. You know, he's comfortable.
Yeah, I think he's, you know, he's making a decent chunk of change, I believe.
A little bit. Yeah, he, you know, here or there. You know, Mike Sweeney hit 340. Despite missing a month, he hit really well all season. Carlos Beltran had 29 home runs. Ronelvis Hernandez, in those 12 starts, he held his own and put himself in a position to start the season in 2003 as one of their top pitchers. And he was a big part in the hot start that they had in 2003 until, you know, he started to fade. And then eventually within a couple of years was really out of the league. But, you know, for that, those 12 starts, he kind of got by. And the big breakout of that year was Raul Ibanez, who had kind of been floating around for a couple of years, hit 294, slugged 537, had 24 home runs. Really kind of came out as, you know, one of the real big bright spots for the Royals in that period. You know, had a couple of good years with the Royals as a result and ended up going on to have a pretty long big league career. And
I was about to say that started a run for him that was, I mean, almost a decade at that point where he was a legit power hitter in baseball.
Yeah. I mean, he went back to Seattle. He ended up in New York. He had just some good years. So, you know, that was one of the very few bright spots of this season. After the year, you know, Paul Byrd left. He ended up signing with Atlanta. Roberto Hernandez left. The Royals weren't going to pay a closer that they, you know, didn't help them the year before because they only won 62 games. Supon left. He was going to make too much in arbitration. They let him leave. Nefi Perez was waived and picked up by the Giants. The Royals were more than happy to get rid of him. They had Baroa in the wings. He ended up taking over at shortstop and had a good season. And despite losing 100 games, David Glass, strangely enough, came out and said that he thought that he would get he was really hoping for a 500 record in 2003. Crazily enough, they did it. just barely. You know what? They were 83-79 that year, but they were in first for three-fourths of it. Pretty crazy. That season also triggered a clause in Mike Sweeney's contract that gave him no opt-out, which ended up leaving him kind of in disdain with some Royals fans because he did miss a lot of time. That stretch in July of 2002 where he missed about a month of the season was his first DL stint. He'd never been on the DL at that point. After that, he was on the DL basically every year, more or less. So, you know, pretty bad omen there. And then the final kind of thing that was in the aftermath, you know, the Royals had already signed Sweeney to that deal. They had him for a number of years. They really felt like they were going to be able to start to rebuild around him. They started negotiations with Carlos Beltran. Some numbers that got thrown around, they offered him, you know, 2 years and $20 million just to you know, cover his arbitration. They offered him 3 years and $25 million to see if he would maybe, you know, cover, you know, give him that 1 year of free agency. Scott Boras wanted 10-year, 15-year kind of contracts. There's the urban legend that they were $1 million apart and it didn't come together. I think that's more or less been confirmed by Bob Dutton and Sam Mellinger, but it still has that kind of that apocryphal kind of feeling to me.
Yeah.
That it's like, I don't know. But he ended up going from untouchable all season to being put on the trading block. So the Royals ended 2002 with a soon-to-be injured Mike Sweeney and Carlos Beltran available for teams to trade for. And that's how they ended their first 100 loss season.
Wow.
Do, do, do.
You know, just to kind of put some additional context onto those. You mentioned the Raul Ibanez. So I pulled it up while you were finishing up there. And starting in 2001, so the year before the Royals' first 100-loss season, which was Ibanez's first year with the Royals, and then going up to 2010, so the first decade of the 2000s, Ibanez was his slash line for those 10 years was 287, 351, 484. He hit 218 home runs in that time period, in that 10 years, and 912 RBIs. So it's kind of interesting. And that was, you know, even though such a bad year, that was kind of more or less the year that started it all, because he had, you know, his most home runs in his career was 13 in a year before that and the year before. But that 2002 season, like you had mentioned, you know, 24 home runs, 103 RBIs really kind of set him off on a pretty solid course there for the rest of his career. He ended up with over 300 home runs. So kind of interesting. There's all these little nuggets that, you know, even in such a bad season that you want to forget, there were some memorable things, you know, and the way you talked about Paul Byrd, I mean, he was a fun player on that team. You know, it was as much as it could happen back then, that was a kind of must watch when he started the game. You know, you're like, oh, Paul Byrd's starting, or let's go out to the ballpark. Or let's make sure we watch it on TV or something, you know. And you look back statistically, and he had like a 3.9 ERA that year, and you think, you know,
what's the big deal?
Yeah, but then you remember the context of 2002, which was, you know, just the height of the steroid boom, right as everything was really going. Because 2004 was kind of when the MLB started to crack down on that, and really kind of things kind of evened out after that. But from like 94 to 2004, it was big time, the quote-unquote steroid era. So the conventional wisdom of what is and isn't a good ERA or good numbers pitching-wise kind of goes out the window, similar to how, you know, what was the norm as far as offensive statistics are concerned. So, you know, it doesn't seem like much, but he was really good. And the, you know, also he threw 228 innings. I mean, I'd be interested to go back and see. I mean, that's got to be the most innings that a Royals pitcher has thrown in a season in quite some time. I don't know that anybody's thrown as much or more since, because I think Greinke was just under that number in his Cy Young season. I think he was at like 216-ish innings pitched.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, they didn't have a lot of good pitchers.
Yeah, which makes it tough.
Is one part. And then the game has changed so much since then that the expectation isn't necessarily to get a lot of innings. It's to get through a lot of starts. And, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he's probably one of very few 200-inning types of performances, especially going that high into it. I mean, you probably have a lot where they're 201 innings, 202 or so, but, you know, to get into the 220s, it's pretty – yeah, that's pretty notable. Before that, yeah, you probably get – I mean, you get into the Dennis Leonards and the Paul Splittorffs and Brett Sabathia.
Oh, yeah,
you start
talking 300.
But that's then. The 70s and 80s. That's a different planet.
Yeah, completely different time.
It doesn't even count, really. So, but, I mean, his ERA plus on Baseball Prospectus was 127. So, I mean, relative to the league – it's pretty good, you know. 3.9 doesn't look pretty, but, you know, when you compare it to everybody else getting bombed, well, you know, it kind of works out.
Yeah. And, you know, that was a couple of years before, as you mentioned, Carlos Beltran got traded. So, you know, that was – he kind of – you know, he had obviously made a name for himself, but really solidified himself that year as, you know, premier player, and you knew, kind of like what you were saying, you know, Royals signing Mike Sweeney, they had Carlos Beltran. There were some things there that they could have used to try and build on, but then 2002 hits and it's like, oh God, you know, and they ended up bouncing back in 2003, but then 2004 and all the rest came, and it was it was over after that. You knew there was no no rebuilding, and really, it'd almost be worth, since we're 15 years apart at some point this season, maybe worth going and looking and seeing exactly how 2003 happened, because that's almost a more fascinating case study, given, you know, what the team looked like on paper, what they did on either side of that. You know, you mentioned 04, 05, 06, 100 plus loss seasons, 02, 100 loss season, but somehow in 2003, they snuck in there and had a winning record.
Yeah.
And who the hell knows how it happened? So maybe we'll do that. Maybe we'll do that later this season and kind of look into that a little bit. Because that'd be fun. But
random ass 2003. Jose Lima doing things. Kevin Apier in August returning and cruising in a couple of games. Just, that was such a weird year.
Yeah. And you know, with back to 2002, there were a couple things I remember growing up with how my dad would talk about the Royals, you know, and he loved them so much, and well, still does. But one of the big things that I think he always kind of talked about was going, you know, into the 90s before the, you know, as they started to kind of take their downturn, he said, you know, he's like, oh, I just don't want them to finish last. You know, they've never finished last in their history. And of course it was, you know, a lot easier when they just had, it was just two divisions. Right. And then it was, you know, seven teams in each one or whatever it was. So a little bit easier to not finish last in that context, but then they, you know, split into the three divisions and makes it a little bit more difficult, but still, you know, they hadn't done it. And then they finished last one year. I can't remember exactly what year was the first year that they'd finished last in the division. But then, you know, so then after that was gone. But it was, you know, just don't lose 100 games. The Royals have never lost 100 games in their history. So he was like, just don't lose 100 games, Royals. And then, of course, 2002 comes.
Sure.
And they lose 100 games, of course. So at that point, it's like, well, you know, there's nothing you can cling to. And that kind of signifies, you know, a lot, I think, in terms of the Royals fandom and how the organization has gone, because – or how the organization went the decade to follow that, because, you know, my dad is as diehard as they come. And, you know, I think that was kind of it wasn't quite this bad, but, you know, that I'm not a huge Simpsons guy, but one of the episodes I remember when Milhouse was on some TV show with Lisa and like asked her out and she said no, and Bart kept rewinding the tape of it and was like, oh, you can actually see his heart break into two pieces right here, and they showed it in slow motion. And so, you know, it's almost kind of like that for the diehard Royals fans like my dad, where it was just like, man, really? It's really gotten this bad?
Yeah.
And, you know, they finished last and they're a 100 loss team, and, you know, there was definitely some pride from a Royals fan standpoint, as there should have been, in how well the Royals had been, you know, from basically since they got into the league until about 1990, you know, they were one of the class of baseball, or one of the, you know, one of the class of baseball teams, where they, you know, constantly doing well, they made the playoffs 7 out of 10 years in the mid-70s to mid-80s. They were rivaling the Yankees. I mean, they were, you know, they were one of the better run organizations in baseball. They were, from that kind of 20-year stretch, they were basically what the Cardinals have been for the last, you know, 20 years or so. And it's so it's really, you know, that was for a lot of people, I think, not necessarily the last straw, because, you know, you don't say they stopped being fans of the team, but kind of just that real breaking point where it was like, okay, the time and energy that I've invested into this, this fandom, I'm going to dial that back now, because there's not much there. They have to prove to me more, you know. And, you know, the next year they kind of bounce back, and it almost made it worse than when they just crashed in 2004. Cause even after 2003, it was like, hey, you know, a lot of predictions in 2004 from the experts even said, hey, Royals are going to win this division. Royals are a legit threat in the Central. They're going to make the playoffs. Everyone was excited.
They had Juan Gonzalez.
Yeah.
I mean,
how can you not win?
What could go wrong with Juan Gonzalez on your team?
But, you know, it all came crashing down. And so 2002 was kind of the start of that, where it just, the whole thing just unraveled. And so, I think it caused a lot of soul searching from the organization. And after 2002, 2006, that 4 out of 5 years, they lost 100 or more games. I mean, and they ended up firing Allard Baird and getting Dayton Moore to come in, and the rest is history, as they say. So it's if that was needed, I guess, to wind up with a 2015 World Championship, so be it, I suppose.
Right.
But it was, and at least they did learn something and kind of change their ways, specifically David Glass at the time. So it was, I'm really glad that you did this, because it's kind of a fun exercise to look back and realize all that happened and kind of remember what it was. And like I was saying earlier, it's easier to look fondly upon these times now that we've got, two pennants and a championship,
right,
that we can look at and say, okay, we made it through, here it is, at least we can wear it kind of as a badge of honor instead of at the time, which was just like embarrassing.
Right. I can't believe we just watched that season.
Yes. So pretty cool, but cool in the relative sense. Of course, not cool to have a 100 loss team at the time, but cool that you did this and put it all together. So
yeah,
fun. It was. We kind of thought it'd be a little fun to go over that. 100 loss for the first 100 loss season for the first 100 episodes of the Baseball Vault as part of BP Kansas City. So is there anything else you wanted to add about this magical season?
The only other things that kind of jumped out to me are just some of the random guys that played. AJ Hinch was on this team for a time. There's a guy named Chan Perry. Never heard of him.
Okay.
He had one hit and 11 at-bats that season. Know nothing about him. So there's that. Kit Pello, obviously, is very important,
yes,
to bring up, who is
big one,
been favorite forever, basically. The main thing that kind of got me when I was kind of looking at the postscript of this is, after the season, the Royals released Blake Stein and Dan Reichert, who I remember back in the 90, like 99, 2000, 2001 with those guys. Stein had been brought over in the Kevin Apier trade with Oakland, and it kind of had some promise. Dan Reichert was a first round pick, and was definitely someone that they felt that he was going
to
be.
Those guys were reasons starter. To be excited.
Yeah, and so by the end of this, those guys got released. Never really panned out. Neither of them really did much after this either. Jeff Austin, another first round pick, he came up. He had 11 innings, most of those early in the year when Hernandez was on the DL. Mike McDougal started showing up. There were some significant names that you'll remember today that came up. Donnie Sadler, who was always, I remember on the old Royal board, he was a guy that people liked a lot. Just a rough year. Brent Maine was their primary catcher, 60 OPS plus. Really never really did. He was never an offensive player that much anyway. He definitely was not this year. So, some random names. That's kind of the main thing that I noticed. Just a lot of those guys I remember really thinking we're going to do it and never panned out. So,
no.
Which is fitting for this team and this stretch.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right. It is fitting.
A lot of disappointing things.
Not a disappointment. So with that, I think we'll leave you. So
yeah, on that happy note.
On that happy note.
How about you watch 7 minutes of credits too after this movie?
Yeah. So don't forget the after credits scene. It's
right.
Important for the next one. So thanks for putting this together. That was really
fun.
That was cool. And it's fun to hear you go through it all.
Well, and I should send out thanks to the Sabre, who they have as a member. They have old Sporting News issues available. That was a big help in kind of getting the big picture stuff. I want to thank Darren Watson, who shared one of his library registrations so I could get some old KC Star archives. Nice. That was really cool. You know, it was fun. It was real fun to kind of look at. So,
yeah. And another thanks to you for being with me on this ride for 100 more episodes under BP Kansas City. This is one of the fun things that we get to do. And I appreciate you being here with me and doing the show. It's always fun.
Well,
so,
couldn't do it without you, or else I'd just sit here and ramble. You keep me on point, so that's good.
Sure. I
sometimes
I do my best, I suppose.
You try so, to. That counts for something.
Yes. We try and stay on track as much as possible. But hopefully the Royals can stay on track to where they are now. Because like I said, you know, 7 out of the last 11, so nothing to scoff at. Only 6 games back. Although they'll probably lose tonight, so who knows how far they'll be now.
Yeah.
But playing a little bit better, having some more exciting, a little bit more fun to watch right as the weather's getting nice. So watch some Royals, watch them on TV, get out to the K, have a good time. We will definitely be back next week. And until then, when you want to get your Royals fix, head on over to BP Kansas City. Leske earlier mentioned an article that Dave Leske put up about it's the Alex Gordon one, right, that you were talking about? Or is that the Alex Gordon one?
Yep.
So about how he's hit the kind of some of the tweaks that he's made and how the success that he's been able to have. And general goodness that we put up every single day as we continue to give you all that Royals knowledge that you so desperately crave. So be sure to visit them. And then as you're enjoying the nice weather, be sure to get out to Kelly's Westport Inn, our longtime sponsor. We've for 100 episodes and well over that, Kelly's has been with us, and we couldn't have done it without them. So thanks to Kelly's for being with us for not only the last 100, but for the many hundreds before that we've recorded over the last 6.5 years that we've done this show. So thank you to Kelly's as our longtime sponsor, and be sure to visit them. Go sit on. They've got a fantastic porch up on the roof, and it's just all around good time. You want to watch a Royals game, you just want to have fun, head on over there. So that's enough to keep you busy until next week when we'll be back again. And that's when we'll see you next. So until then, thank you so much for stopping by. See you next week. And as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com. Every town has a place where elites gather for witty conversations over trendy cocktails. Kansas City, that place is definitely not Kelly's Westport Inn. From its humble beginnings at the corner of Westport Road and Pennsylvania Avenue, Kelly's Westport Inn has seen it all. Pioneer wagon trains filled with families heading west, Civil War battles, and Major League Baseball championships. Kelly's is born of history and tradition, and we hope you'll allow us to become part of your history and traditions as well. Kelly's Westport Inn, 500 Westport Road, Kansas City, Missouri.